Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop, my bookshop. Then I wrote here, blah, 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 which means instead of me going through all the social media, just Google us. Everything's there. Google's nice to us because of our YouTube channel. We pop to the top, and all the stuff we do should be there, including open mic night and book clubs and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, today we're pleased to have with us J.C. Holman, author of Bee and Me, published in March by Simon & Schuster. J.C. has also written William and Henry James with regard to their correspondence, another book, In Utopia. He's an anthologist, The Story of the Story, Volume 1 and Volume 2, The Hospital for Bad Poets, The Devil's a Gentleman, and The Chess Artist, which, as I thought about it, is quite a wide variety of different topics and approaches. But today we're going to be talking about Bee and Me, so let's set the stage. In 1991, Nicholson Baker wrote a book called You and I about his own life and its vague intersections and unions to the works of John Updike, one of my favorite authors. It may have been the beginning of, if you will, the genre of creative criticism. Now J.C. has taken that work and moved it forward into our time, into kind of a wide-ranging and frankly disconcerting voyage between his own life and sensibilities and the writings of Nicholson Baker. So here's the deal. I've interviewed like over 200 authors now on this show, and frankly, this book has perplexed me like no other. I think either I am too dumb to understand what creative criticism is, or I am too smart to accept it as a literary premise. I don't know. So let's talk about it. Welcome, J.C. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Sam. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Sure. So for our listeners, perhaps one of whom has heard the term, what is creative criticism?
Well, creative criticism is a term that was first coined by a critic, a guy named J.E. Spingarn, way back in 1910. And he was trying to offer up something that was a kind of counter to this sort of dispassionate approach of standard literary criticism, what we think of as literary criticism. And he was really thinking backward to people like Walter Pater and Matthew Arnold. And creative criticism itself came from a quote from Goethe. And all it really means is that you're writing about books in a way that doesn't artificially sublimate your subjectivity, your passion for books. It seems kind of strange when you think about it that, books have this huge range of emotions that they offer us, sadness and anger and arousal and passion and poignancy. And then we get told once we get into school that somehow, for some reason, when we write about books, we're not supposed to include any of that. And so probably the easiest way to understand what I think Spingarn was trying to get at in creative criticism and what many writers between him and now have done in trying to write about books in a more passionate way is simply allowing that a book that is about another book can have that same range of emotions that we associate with literature.
Yeah, but the thing about it... The thing about it is, to me, and in some of the reviews too, is like, suppose I post on Facebook that I'm reading Bee and Me while I'm eating a piece of chocolate cake, and they both remind me. The chocolate cake really reminds me of Bee and Me. I can't say why. Why am I, the reader of both, supposed to be interested in that?
Well, I think, Proust once said that one of the things that we remember most about books is where we were when we read them. That's one of the most memorable things. So reading as an event would seem to contain the context of the reading in addition to what gets read. And so in writing about literature, when we go on to make our claims about books we've read, or we want to share our experience of what we've read, we can include the context of our reading, but I would say that you should only include those things that really bear on what it is you have to say, what you have to say about the work that is under consideration, and if you are, it's the difference between including the self and indulging the self. To include the self is not necessarily to indulge the self. I think that's the way in which you escape being self-indulgent, by only including those aspects of your experience which actually bear on whatever it is that you're trying to express.
Well, if you look at it like your girlfriend Catherine approaching you, although you can't really tell for sure, but, and that's the thing, I'm allowed to remember your book any way I want. That's the interesting thing, because I can say that the book ended up having covers that were shaped like bird's wings that were about to fly out of a gilded cage. That's not what you said,
but
it's pretty close to what you said, and that's the way picture I had in my mind, right? Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
Well, you know, I think, you know, to back up a little bit, to give, you know, so your listeners some context,
I always forget about them.
Well, you know, the book I wrote is really two stories. You know, it's the story of my partner Catherine and I, and it's the story of reading Nicholson Baker. And, you know, it begins at a moment of crisis in my life when, as a result of having published a few books and having taught for a while, I've kind of begun to lose my literary faith. You realize that you know, literature is a business, and that higher education is a business, and that these are institutions, and that so much of what literature is doing these days gets channeled through these institutions, and it's enough to challenge your literary faith. So that's where I am. And then I meet my partner Catherine, and we fall in love, and then I realize, well, you know, I need to do something to regenerate, to renew my literary faith, and Catherine consents this too. And I strike on this idea to read this author whom I'd heard of, but I'd never actually read, and to read him in total. And Catherine encourages me to do this. She's sort of part of the endeavor from the very beginning. And so, you know, the story of our relationship during this, you know, couple of year-long period of me reading Nicholson Baker is tied to the reading that I'm doing, and what I'm trying to do by telling those stories is telling both of those stories is to demonstrate and embody this argument that who we are as we read is important to what we think we've read.
Well, the thing about it is there's such a run-up to you actually beginning, and you kind of joke about it. See, the thing is, I can't tell. Here's a perfect example, and it's embarrassing for me to talk about, but it's in your book in frank graphic detail. Uh-huh. So I will talk about it. So, because you wrote it. It's like when you're talking about teaching students in your classroom, and you kind of go into this thing about how you, it's almost like you hate them, and they're drooling and mucus coming out of their nose, and then you go home and masturbate thinking about them, and they masturbate thinking about you, and I'm thinking, God, this is horrible. How's he ever going to get a job again? Then I think, wait a minute, is he kidding? Is this really what he thinks? Is this really what he does? And it's like, you confused me so much there, because I'm thinking to myself, why would anyone lay this naked self out when they're really only trying to talk about an author that they haven't even begun to read yet? So explain that to me.
Well, you know, I think there's a great deal in Nicholson Baker's career about the difficulty of telling the truth. You know, that was really striving after the hard truths, the truths that are both hard to utter and hard to hear. And I think what I'm trying to do is be true to the nature of the crisis that I'm describing. And, you know, so the section that you're referring to is kind of the culmination of this crisis of the teaching life. And, you know, I think, you know, in the book it's actually in pretty hyperbolic terms, and it's hypothetical. You know, I say something about students and teaching Alice Munro's Lives of Girls and Women, and the truth is I've never actually taught Alice Munro's Lives of Girls and Women. So, you know, at that moment I'm trying to be, you know, to be over the top, to engage in some hyperbole, and to be true to the panic of a reading life that particularly now these days. It's harder and harder to generate the kind of ardor that it takes to really take in someone's whole body at work. It's a daunting task, and when storytelling in book form has so many media to compete with, it makes the whole endeavor that much more difficult and that much more of a discipline. And the dauntingness of that discipline is the thing that I'm trying to capture there.
Okay, well then, I don't know if I buy that completely, because it either did happen or didn't happen, and I don't know. If it's like Ulysses' episode in Nighttown, yeah, okay, sure, I can buy that, that's fine. But if you really do go home and do this, and how am I supposed to know as a reader? It's like the way you take off on Martin Amis. I don't know if you hate him, but you sure as hell seem like you hate him. And then to compare him to his father and say that girls that he has sex with are only doing it because they can get this vague dissolution, of his seed into them. And I'm thinking, does he really mean that? And then does he really mean at the end, hey, maybe I should read his stuff? And I'm thinking, I'm thinking, what?
Well, I think with the Martin Amis thing, the role that Martin Amis plays in the book, Martin Amis is a famous literary bad boy. Lots and lots of people have said mean things about Martin Amis before I did, and really, there's a kind of long literary tradition of writers saying scathing things about one another, and that's kind of odd, isn't it? Since we normally associate reading and books and authors with love. We love authors, and so I was trying to be true to that part of our reading lives, and trying to demonstrate that in some instances we're really irrational when we consider authors that we haven't read, and then I think the same holds true for the previous sequence that you're referring to. If you talk to teachers or to students, for that matter, particularly in English classes, the idea that in English classes where you're going to be talking about books which often have sexual content, the results of those conversations aren't going to result in the stray thought between teacher and student, it seems almost preposterous to say that that's not going to happen or that that doesn't happen. And the truth is that, actual relationships, and we're really only talking about like a stray random thought in my book, but actual full-blown relationships between teachers and students, even between female teachers and male students in high school, I mean, it's so common as to be practically cliche. So I think that my book in both of these instances is a little shocking, only because it's in the context of a book that is about another book. Our real lives are actually way, way more explicit. And again, I'm trying to take a book about books and allow it to be as explicit as the life that all of those other books are supposed to be about.
Well, look, I'm not looking at this like it's James Frey's A Million Little Pieces. I understand that. It's not a memoir. I get that. But where I'm perplexed, like I said at the beginning, and I'm not trying to be pushing you or anything, it's just that I honestly don't know what you believe, because I'm reading it as if this is your life. I'm reading it as if Catherine's in the bathroom using the electric razor. You become semi-tumescent. You go in there. You begin to assist her. I'm reading that as the truth. You haven't yet even begun to read the books that you're going to be talking about. So yep. What am I supposed to do? I am confused.
Well, I think if you look at Baker's You and I, he, for about the same amount of time before he actually begins talking about Updike and what he has to say about Updike, he frets and staggers his way through quite a long time before that book actually sort of begins in a traditional sense. And I'm definitely mirroring that book in how this book is constructed, and so I think I'll stand by everything that's in the book in terms of what it says. Yeah, that scene in the bathroom takes place, and the other scenes that you're referring to, they're a little more hypothetical than I think you're allowing.
I'm not allowing anything. I'm not allowing anything. I'm not angry either. It's just that when I read it, I don't know. And like I said, it may be just because I'm dumb. When I read it, I'm assuming it's hard to tell whether your life is partly fictional or not in order to. And I understand Nicholson Baker had the same problems. But for example, when you talk about Nicholson Baker going into McDonald's and you go, frankly, McDonald's is a scary place. Well, McDonald's is not a scary place to me. It has lousy food and I won't go in there. But why am I supposed to believe that it's a scary place because you say it is?
Well, I didn't say scary. I said it's an embarrassing place.
And yeah, but remember, I'm just remembering your book.
Okay, well, then I'm correcting your memory because I said embarrassing. And I said embarrassing because Baker said embarrassing. What I didn't do was give a large context for that embarrassing because it wasn't germane to what I was talking about, this revelation he has while reading William James's work in that restaurant. He goes through this long process of exchanging a whole bunch of pennies so that he can get a free sandwich, and this ties up the line at McDonald's, and this causes him to become embarrassed. And I would say that those kinds of promotions that McDonald's puts on or fast food restaurants puts on are pretty characteristic of what they do. Yeah, you can get free food, but you're going to have to do something that is probably going to cause you some kind of embarrassment, and so that's why I say that.
Okay, well, I'll give you that one, but I still don't agree with it. But
this is the argument that the guy who reviewed the book for the New Republic came up with, and I disagree with that characterization. You know, I think that he too in that review chose to leave out this whole background thing about the pennies because it wasn't germane to the point he was trying to make. But the point he was trying to make was just mistaken.
But it's like when two authors used to fight in the 19th century, and they go back and forth and back and forth, and that's what you would do with the New Republic. Then he'd come back and say, no, you're wrong. And then for someone who's in the middle of this watching it, it's like, I don't know, it's like, and it's cool, too, that before you read him, you realize that he's interested in some of the same people that you're interested in. It's like when Carl Jung dreams about a fish, then he walks along and sees a fish on the whatever, and he gets like six fishes a day, and it's like,
yeah,
it's like that, and he kind of becomes that to you. But I'll give you a perfect example of what I think creative criticism is. When I was a little boy, I was 12, and I was reading the A&P story by John Updike, and I didn't get it. Of course, I was 12, so of course I didn't get it. So I wrote John Updike a letter, and I said, I'm not sure I understand what this story means. And he wrote me a letter back, and he said, perhaps a simple rereading will help. And I've kind of lived by that. And what a great letter. It was a postcard, 3 cents postage. And he sent the postcard back. I still have it. And I'm thinking, that's really creative criticism. I actually interacted with the guy. I asked him a question about why I couldn't get his book, and he told me why I couldn't. That would be the most pristine, the platonic ideal of, in my mind, creative criticism. It's not written for the public. Yeah, you know? I don't know.
I think that when Updike says go back and reread the story, I think he's suggesting that maybe it's not appropriate to ask an author to interpret their own work. And what strikes me, well, a couple of things strike me about the reaction to Be and Me, the huge range of reviews that the book's gotten. So, incredible raves from the Washington Post and the San Francisco Chronicle, and then pretty negative responses from the Chronicle of Higher Ed and the New Republic. And what's striking about that is that it's very similar to the reviews that you and I got when you and I first came out. It was called childish and self-indulgent and on and on and on, and it was really surprising. And what struck me about those reviews of you and I, which has since gone on to be pretty much a classic, is that the people who wrote those reviews, they didn't really read the book. They had their gripes, but you could tell that it was almost because it was a nonfiction that they didn't think that they needed to read or to read into it. And so, of course, what you want to say to them is, yes, what Updike said was, well, maybe you should go back and reread the book.
Well, it's funny because, when you say that you welcome criticism because it's a public display of affection. I kind of understand that. Whether it's a bad review or a good review, it means someone's paying attention to you and is willing to give their thoughts on the matter, which is what I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of understand it if that's the way you meant it. But I don't know. Again, I don't know the way you meant it.
Well, when I say that, you know, that's very early in the book, and I say, well, criticism should be a public display of affection. But then, of course, that immediately gets turned around when I start talking about you and I find these things to gripe about. You know, me too. I'm reading a book, and I'm finding these things to get riled up about. One of the lines that I'm most happy with in the book is very quick parenthetical, where I just simply point out that outrage is a form of arousal. That, you know, books do generate very happy emotions in us. They please us. They're pleasurable. They can even entertain us. But sometimes they make us really angry. You know, they outrage us. And if that can be a good thing, if it, you know, kicks us out of the sort of dull daily torpor of life and gets us excited about something. You know, and to my mind, all criticism, any kind of criticism, really means is that you read something, you read a book, you see a movie, and you're so riled by it, you're so roused by it or aroused by it, that you immediately want to find someone else and talk to them about it. You need to share your experience. You need to take the private experience you have with a book and share it with another person. You want to find someone else who's read it and see what they think. And I think that is really the most fundamental emotion to what we call criticism, and we've largely forgotten that, I would argue. And the other point to make about this is that if you are outraged by a book, I think that creates a greater impetus in you to go back and make sure you're right about the book, because even though, yes, you can, you know, take away whatever you take away from book is your takeaway, it is certainly possible to be wrong about a book, to have come to an impression of it that is not based on what's actually in the book, and which therefore comes more from you than from the book.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'll go back now and read In Utopia. I'll go back and read The Chess Artist. I haven't read any of your work. I'm just like you were going into, you're somebody who's non-canonical.
Non-canonical, yeah.
Yeah, and okay, so I'm not supposed to be reading you necessarily, but I will now. And so, yeah, your premise is true. The other thing that's interesting is, like, could you switch sides and argue my side such as it is? It's like, if this was a debate and the proposition was one thing, could you switch sides? Could you go both ways on what you're doing?
And argue what exactly?
Argue that creative criticism isn't really a valid, I don't know what other word to use, but genre, that it isn't really important to me in understanding the work of another to know what you're doing at any given moment or how it affects you on a quotidian, daily basis with regard to, you know, waking up, tying your shoelaces, and going to work.
Well, sure. You know, I mean, I think that we're actually talking about what I would call sort of a slice of the possibility of creative criticism.
Yeah.
In the sense that, I edited these two anthologies of creative criticism of the way that writers have written about other books as opposed to the way that critics have tended to write about books. And in those two anthologies, The Story About the Story and The Story About the Story 2, there's a whole range of this kind of work. And some of it is confessional. Some of it does have people telling stories about their lives as they're reading. This includes, you know, people like Catherine Ann Porter or Thomas Mann or Charles D'Ambrosio. But not all of them, you know. So when Virginia Woolf is writing about Hemingway, for example, in a really famous essay, there's no confession. There's no confession of who she is or what the context of her life is. But there's the passion there. There's the irony in her voice. There is a subjectivity that she has chosen not to artificially sublimate. So creative criticism is not defined by confession of one's life predicament, but by a resistance to artificially sublimating who you really are, your sensibility.
Yeah, it's funny because the title You and I is an obvious title, and I understand it because his last name is Updike. Updike, so it's you and I, two different people that are looking at each other theoretically. Mm-hmm. But then when I read your title, B and Me, at first I was thinking, well, that's not so smart because it's just B and Me. But then when you go into Martin Buber and the I and thou aspect, well, not aspect, it is life, then the title kind of made more sense to me. I don't even know if that's right or not, but...
No, yeah, that definitely was something I had in mind. You know, when I eventually meet Baker in the book and I ask him about this, he admits that he hasn't read Martin Buber, and so I sort of think, oh, well, this connection from you and I to Martin Buber's I and thou is sort of invalid, you know, but then I later discovered that John Updike had talked about Martin Buber in a book called A Month of Sundays, and had used Buber's I and thou comparison or that linkage as a way of understanding the reader-writer relationship. And of course, Updike's A Month of Sundays is one of the books that Baker admits to having read in You and I. So there is some kind of indirect influence. And then for me, B and Me is kind of a it's a double entendre because it's, you know, it's both B and Me as well as being me.
Mm-hmm.
And of course that has some resonances in Martin Buber as well.
Well, maybe I'm understanding it slightly better now, this helps. But the I and thou thing, it's like, you know, with regard to a Zen, you know, like a Shambhala kind of Chögyam Trungpa kind of thing. We're all born Buddha babies, and it's just one world, and we're the universe, and we're God, and we're everything. And it's the separation, which is what you're talking about, that actually gives us, you know, either a sadder, it does give us a sadder but wiser perspective on life,
mm-hmm.
but which I would much prefer than to have faith in, you know, a Christian God and have nothing else. Man, my life would be really easy and really happy. But, yeah, and you talk about that in your religion book. See, I haven't even read it, and I know you talk about that. That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it was kind of, even though it looks like, this was true of Baker, too, even though there seems to be all of these different subjects running between books, there is kind of a continuous thread running through them. And, yeah, the Buber thing was really fascinating to me because, you know, he... was essentially, you know, articulating what I was going through about this kind of a crisis at the beginning of the book. You know, he says, well, we all start out with these I and you relationships, and he's talking about the maternal bond. But then the you turns into its, and we have relationships with institutions rather than with people. And, of course, this creates what he calls modern man's lack of relation. And he sees this as a crisis. He sees this as something that is wrong with the modern world. And what he wants to do is figure out how to return people to the I-you from the I-it. And that's very much the story that I'm trying to tell in B and Me, and how the way that you do that is by dedicating yourself to a real reading life, you know, which to my mind means not reading simply the books that you get told to read or the books that wind up on bestseller lists or on, you know, celebrity lists or whatever, but by finding those writers who really speak to you in some essential way, who seem to be about you in some way, and then reading them exhaustively and with dedication.
It's funny because when you talk about the idea of reading in America now being a form of entertainment, and then immediately optioned to be a movie, whether you're talking about All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr, which I loved that book. You almost make me feel guilty for loving it. The Nightingale, which I haven't read yet. Orphan Train, Gone Girl, for God's sakes, Girl on a Train. You know, it's like I'm in my bookstore. Those are on the two front tables, and I'm in the back reading Kafka, which again goes back to one of your articles. You know, it's very Kafka-esque. And so
right.
Then I haven't read that. But I know that we can relate on some level to that. So I guess I'm understanding better now. But it's kind of like going to the dentist.
Well, you know, the entertainment thing is really amazing because it's a, you know, it's almost an unassailable position to take. You know, that books should entertain us. Of course, they should on some level, right? They should be, you know, something that we enjoy doing. But there are so many things that we do with our lives that entertain us or are pleasurable precisely because they present us with some kind of challenge. You know, people climb mountains, or they play incredibly difficult video games,
or they play chess.
Right, or they play chess, or they crochet huge afghans. They do things that at the end give them a sense of satisfaction and accomplishment, and precisely because they're something of a challenge. And books aren't really in that category anymore. And it's amazing because, you know, the word entertainment, when you really think about it, sort of means precisely the opposite. If you make me an offer or a proposal and I say I will entertain that proposal, I mean I will think about it. I will consider it. And so the thought I come to in the book is that it's not that books should be entertaining us, it's that we should be entertaining books.
Well, I guess it's the idea of when you say you'll entertain something, it's engaging. And I guess, again, and I don't mean to keep beating a dead horse, but it's the engagement that drove both Mr. Baker's book, and it's the engagement that seems to be driving your book, but I don't know.
I hope so. I mean, I think that you know, and what engages us in a book? Well, I hope it's that you encounter a sensibility that is being honest about a full human range of emotions. I think that particularly with pop culture, entertainment, television. The television obviously has been getting a lot better in recent years, but you read so many books and you see so much popular entertainment that simply appeals to emotions you already have, or tells you things you already believe. And what about those books and those other media that present us with experiences that are truly novel? And isn't that a little closer to what we hope storytelling does in the world?
Yeah, and that's why it's very interesting that I know who Kim Kardashian is and Kanye West. I don't want to. I don't want to use up more of my brain. I want to save it for more important things. But
right.
You know, you know who they are. That goes back to your book too. You're not going to read anything she writes or look at her new book called Selfish, which is all her selfies. But you know who she is. You know you don't like the concept of her or being famous for being famous, but here we could talk about her for a long time.
Right. You know, I mean, and this becomes, you know, a competition. You know, a competition to a serious life of the mind. We're bombarded by all of this information, and somehow, you know, books have got to find their way to us. And that's, you know, that's why there is this big fretful period at the front of B and Me, because it takes a long time for Baker to really insinuate himself into my brain as he's competing with all of these other things that I'm doing. I'm reading other books, I'm teaching, you know, I'm trying to write stuff of my own. And I think that, you know, as the range of storytelling media has exploded in the 20th century. So it used to be, you know, we just had like something like, you know, opera and theater to compete with, but now books are competing with, they're competing not only with the, you know, digital books, but also with, you know, with film and television. It's harder and harder to find those writers who are really going to play an important role in our lives, and we might even find ourselves actively resisting them, even when they're precisely the book that we should seek out and read.
Well, if you're talking about the canon, for example, and you were Dr. Phil giving advice to somebody who's sick of being entertained by pablum, then in my bookstore, would you tell them go into the back where the used books are and pick up War and Peace or Anna Karenina? What would you tell them to do? Or read Ulysses? Or what's your advice then?
Well, you know, yeah, that's you know, that's I think that you know, I say at one point that that even though ostensibly B and Me is a book about reading the work of Nicholson Baker, it's not really a book about Nicholson Baker. It's a book about finding a writer who can save you, right? Now that I'm in this period of crisis, and so there's a sort of a salvation narrative. And so, you know, the advice I would give would be probably a little disappointingly nonspecific. You know, it would be to seek out, you know, those writers that can speak to your experience, that can include you, that can trigger and activate you in a way that don't simply just sort of dull your emotions for the duration of the reading experience. Where do you find that?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's browsing is a really good thing. I mean, that's one thing that we've certainly lost as more and more people come to associate books with Amazon rather than bookstores like yours.
I know.
To simply go in and browse, you know, I talk about this at one point in the book. It's only in reading an actual book that it's easy to, you know, to pre-read books or to reread books or to flip through them and sample them. That's not easy. That's not even easy on a Kindle, right? You know, but in a bookstore you can do that. And it's almost as though what we've forgotten how to do is browse.
Well, the funny thing is the way the bookstore started was my library at home was like, it was overflowing the house. So I said, okay, I'll open a little bookstore, and I took all my books out and put them in the bookstore. Then when I went home, the library was full again. It was like hangers multiplying in your closet at night. But the coolest thing to watch is someone who's looking for a specific book in the back, and you have to look at the book to the left of it, and you have to look at the book to the right of it.
Right,
and one
right,
of those
right.
books may change your life.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, I mean, and I think as well, you know, simply, you know, engaging in the communities of books, you know, like once you find a writer. I mean, this is kind of where it comes back to criticism. I think when, you know, we come into school and you get told, you know, okay, now you're going to write about books, but you're going to do it in a dispassionate way and you're going to argue something, you know, and all of the passion that we have for books as kids gets drained away in so many students. I see this again and again. And that's really unfortunate because it's precisely that kind of writing about reading which triggers in us, you know, passion or anger or arousal or poignancy or whatever that can help other people also find the kinds of writers who might save them. You know, so maybe someone reads my book and they don't go read Nicholson Baker, but they've heard us talk about Martin Buber. And
right.
then they rush off and they read Martin Buber. You know, and so that would be another way to be actively engaging in that other kind of writing about reading, which isn't about arguing things and isn't artificially dispassionate.
Well, taking it one step beyond, which again is very pragmatic for my bookstore, if you do have a girl in your class who tilts her head, she's already predisposed to what you want to see happen to readers. What about the person who is drooling on the desk? I mean, obviously you can't reach some people, but what's your methodology with regard to trying to change a person from going home and playing Game of War to deciding to venture out into a different world? That's what you do as a teacher, so how do you do it?
Well, you know, so interestingly, you know, when I started reading this kind of better writing about reading, it was precisely just giving students some license to include the context of themselves in what they write about books, that actually made them excited in a way that they weren't, because they'd been told not to do it. And interestingly, it wasn't the English students who responded best to that. It was like the engineers,
yeah.
and the business students,
yeah.
everybody who wasn't already an English major, that they could take to this. And of course, I had to be there to police them, to make sure that what they were writing wasn't simply self-indulgence, right? That they included themselves, but they recognized that they only included themselves to the extent that it let them say something insightful and illuminating about the book they were considering.
Well, that
winds up, I think, waking up a lot of students, so they're no longer drooling on the desk.
Well, I would have to say that that's kind of like training wheels, which is fine, but...
Well, that's the class we're talking about. We're talking about an entry level.
Yeah.
You know, I think once you get to to graduate level, and I've taught that too. I mean, it's a totally different thing. And then you don't have to worry about the student drooling on the desk, because this is somebody who's already decided to dedicate their lives to this. And you can talk about a whole range of different things. But when you're talking about the students who are drooling on the desk, you are talking about training wheels.
Well, it does. I feel completely different than I did when we first started talking, or when I finished the book. But I still, I'm still like slightly unsure about things. But it definitely has changed the way I've looked at it. So I guess this is exactly what you're looking to do, right?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I think the book does have this wide range of emotions. I mean, we haven't talked much about Baker's work at all, but Baker has got these three really challenging, explicit books of literary pornography. And so when I decided to be pretty explicit in my book, it was totally appropriate to the subject matter, to trying to understand what he's doing in his work. And of course, the organizing principle of my book is this idea of arousal. It's Being Me, a True Story of Literary Arousal. And then we've forgotten on some level that books, maybe the most natural metaphor we have for books is this kind of physical intimacy. And again, in a context of a book about books, that might be shocking. But it isn't really, my book is not terribly explicit when you compare it to something like Girls or to Lars von Trier or to MTV videos. Yeah. I think we're inundated with that level of explicitness, and it's only in the context of a book about books that you might say, hey, can you do that? And I'm more than happy to be the guy who comes along and says, yes, you can do that, because that reinforces the notion that books matter to our lives as we actually live them.
That's a tough thing to do, and you did do it. There's no question about it. Whatever people think about it, you definitely did do it. But I remember when my brother gave me Vox, and I read it. Of course, now it's kind of dated, like Neuromancer, but because the world has changed so incredibly. And then, Fermata and the Mezzanine, I was just knocked out by all three of those. And I can't say that I've kept up with his work since then, but it's like you at the very end when you say, well, Martin Amis, you go, well, maybe I should read his books. Mm-hmm. Are you going to? Did you? Will you?
Yeah, I did. I read several Martin Amis books, and he didn't grab me in quite the same way Baker did, I'm really glad that I did it. I mean, I think, what I was doing with Amis and Baker in the book, as Amis became, the next writer that I had begun to think about, that I had begun to feel drawn to without knowing why, and I was resisting it. I read London Fields, and I read Time's Arrow, and I read the Rachel Papers, and he's an amazingly brilliant guy. He just didn't quite grab me in the same way Baker did. I read a few and I moved on, which is totally ordinary, and totally acceptable. I mean, that's sort of very much how our reading lives work. I quote Amis to his credit in Be and Me, from a review he has of DeLillo from The New Yorker. He says that, what we mean when we say we love a writer is that we love about half their work. And that in and of itself, sort of gets to the irrationality of our reading lives, we love them or we don't, and it's inexplicable on some level. But our relationships with other people are just as inexplicable, and that's how it should be. We should have that same range of emotions in reaction to an author as we have, as the same range of emotions that we have to the people that we love, which means that we probably can't explain why we love them, and we probably can't explain why they also get under our skin sometimes.
Yeah.
Right? Why they drive us crazy.
Like John Irving. I mean, how many times can you read about bears and wrestlers? I thought it, when you said that, I thought of Thomas Pynchon, Faulkner, and John Irving. I mean, you're right. I love half of it, and I don't love the other half.
Right. I mean, and so, what I'm trying to do is to demonstrate and embody the way that our relationship with authors has that full range of human emotions. It's not dispassionate, and it's not always a simple kind of pleasure or love. It's got a wide range of emotions.
Well, with that, that's a great time to stop, because, like I said, I definitely think this was, whether anyone is listening or not, I just definitely think this is well worth it for me, because it's not something you get to do often, which is exactly what your book is about, which is talking to the author and being able to, you know, engage and learn what he was trying to do, whether you agree with it or not. So thank you so much for being here. It's a pleasure talking to you.
Great. Thanks a lot, Sam.
So that was J.C. Holman talking to me and you about Be and Me, A True Story of Literary Arousal. His interactions, both real, virtual, and in his own mind, with Nicholson Baker, who previously wrote a book about John Updike in the same context, which is now called Creative Criticism. And I still have issues with it, but it was nice talking to him to get his point of view and also to kind of try and learn about what this thing actually is. I'm still not sure. Anyway, so as usual, we got a lot of people coming up. Judith Clare Mitchell, Courtney Maum, a couple of others that are coming up, and then I think I'm going to be, one interesting thing I'm going to be doing is on August 18th in the Hamptons, they have this author's night that's hosted by Alec Baldwin and Christina Baker Klein, author of Orphan Train, who I've interviewed here and who was at our bookstore for a signing that had like 130 people. We could have had 500, but we had to close it off. So I'm going to be getting those authors at the Authors Night in the Hamptons, where it'll benefit the Hampton Library, and it should be a lot of fun. So not that anyone's going to go up there, but I'm really enjoying working with them on that program. So thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking to Mr. Holman. I'm not sure whether he enjoyed that much talking to me, but in any way, it's a fascinating work. It'll be on our front table. It would be a great book club book because, geez, there'd be so many different viewpoints on it. And pick it up and look at it. And if you don't like it, you don't like it. But it will give rise to a lot of questions in your head. And as he also said, there's a lot of passion. And even if you get angry at the book, what it does is it does allow you to engage with the author. And that's what writing and reading books is all about. So we'll talk to you next week. Thanks again, as always, for joining us here on the Avid Reader.